how do you do that? How do you connect to it in such a way that makes vulnerable, that tells that story within the notes of love and heartbreak, of this depth emotional range? I've never understood. I can't play. And I'm sorry, we're going to run along this morning. What goes through your head when you do that? As a difference, can someone out there tell me what goes through your head when he does that?
Amazement.
Yeah, amazing.
And impressed.
I see a dance. I see love won and lost. I see a battle for it. And my friend, you are welcome here anytime. Let's give him another hand. Vulnerability, these words of David White, vulnerability is not a weakness, a passing indisposition, or something we can arrange to do without. Vulnerability is not a choice. Vulnerability is the underlying, ever-present, abiding undercurrent of our natural state. To run from vulnerability is to run from the essence of our nature. The attempt to be invulnerable is the vain attempt to become something we are not, and most especially to close off our understanding of the grief of others. More seriously, in refusing our vulnerability, we refuse the help needed at every turn of our existence and immobilize the essential tidal and conversational foundations of our identity. Our theme this month is generosity. I will approach it a little differently than I approach generosity when we're in our annual stewardship campaign. See, this is a story about a journey, one that never finishes once it's been started. And we begin the story today because there is no better teacher in this world than the experience of a journey. This is my experience, a walk through equality, or a walk through equally the darkest and most hopeful time of my life, as we embrace the ideas of generosity and what vulnerability means while we do that. This sermon begins, as most do, with me. It's a beginning, not the first beginning, but a beginning. I remember a day in 2010 when everything came crashing down around my hubris. I wrote in my journal, "I've never been so full of emptiness." See, that was the day I lost my job. Actually, it was the day I lost my career. See, I knew I would never fit in preaching with my prior faith. My theology didn't match up enough with that. I couldn't pass the purity and doctrinal belief tests. What I could do was sit with people when life was difficult in their tragedy, so that's what I chose to do. I was a chaplain, a medical chaplain, and I forsook my love of preaching to sit with those who were most lost. It was around that same time that I was trying to move from my apartment just south of Memphis, Tennessee, to Jackson, Mississippi, so that I could marry the woman of my dreams. I never found a job in Jackson, though. I found a hospice chaplain job in Grenada, Mississippi, which is about the halfway point, and I took it. So I did what you do when you're about to move. I applied for an apartment. I got a pod, so I had time. And I got an apartment, left an apartment, moved from Memphis, where I had connections, opportunities to move up in my career, I had friends, I had everything, and I moved from Memphis to this small town in Mississippi called Grenada that has nothing. Just so one day I could move to Jackson, Mississippi. I remember one night I unpacked in my apartment in Grenada, I unpacked my last book in my new home office. It was the last box. And it was the first time I had unpacked my entire library since finishing seminary some 4 to 5 years earlier. But I knew that I was going to be here a while. So that night I walked to the dumpster and threw that last box away. But then those pesky doctrinal issues came up again. See, 2 weeks before this moment when I unload this last book, I was in an all-chaplain meeting of the company I worked for in Jackson, Mississippi. The chief chaplain was talking, and all I remember were the words. He said that at the end of the day, the true job is to bring people to Christ. And without thinking, I rose my hand. And I said, that's not my job. I articulated that I was facilitating the faith of others. I was serving, not trying to proselytize. I'd always said I was a member of one denomination, but I functioned as a Unitarian. And because of that, and my innate ability to push against leaders and use of a little strong language that they were not used to men of the cloth wearing, I was told that day, 2 weeks later, when I had just the day after when I had just unpacked my last book, that my services would no longer be required. My career went to shit. That's that language I mentioned before. I got more boxes. I repacked my books. I left my new apartment in Grenada and began on a different journey, not the one I expected. Many years of couch surfing. The address on my driver's license was a UPS store. My stuff was in storage. And you understand why you get a UPS box and not a P.O. box, right? When you're homeless. Because that's a physical address, and you can trick them into thinking you have a house. My stuff was in storage. I was homeless. In fact, it wasn't until years later, I would say I was essentially homeless. It wasn't until years later that that actually is the definition of being homeless, is having no home to go to. I would go from homes to home and sleep. There's this aspect of this that I would never get over, the fear and the shame, but I'll always remember that had that not happened, I probably would have never truly become a UU in return to the pulpit in which I loved. But even though Fred Rogers always said that we were worthy of love, it was hard to feel worthy during that time. I bounced from job to job. I slept on couches. I started taking Xanax just so I could sleep at night. I had hard, miserable days, the weakest worker on a construction crew, or the slowest member of a landscaping crew. Except when I was jobless and collecting unemployment or fighting with previous employers about why I felt like I deserved it. See, there is this point in looking for work where I filled out job application after job application to the point where there were no more jobs to apply for. And then there's this weird feeling, what do I do when I've finished the applications, when there are no more to fill out? Unemployment continued for a long time. See, I either had too much education or too little experience. In Jackson, Mississippi, there were no chaplain jobs available. I was told any job is better than no job, yet any job would never call back. When I could no longer fill out apps or pound the pavement, all I could do was wait for a phone call that year after year never came. And because I was living handout after handout, you know, they talk about living paycheck to paycheck, I was living handout after handout, I did not feel worthy of love. Because a little generosity and a little heart stretch is good, but in my approximation, at the time, I was living too much on the generosity of others. I was a mooch. I was lazy. I was worthless. Or so I heard over and over again in my head, even if I was the only one saying it. Even when I returned to ministry, I was underemployed and would remain so until somewhere around August 2022. It might have been October that year that I unboxed and shelved the last of my books from storage. Still with the fear that the day I shelved it would be the last day. In fact, I kept that box hidden in my office behind a red couch for months, just in case. Because the fight for self-worth is never truly won. So at this point, I dig into an author named Brené Brown. She says, "We need to consider letting go of the myth of self-sufficiency. One of the greatest barriers to connection is the cultural importance we place on going it alone. Somehow we've come to equate success with not needing anyone. Many of us are willing to extend a helping hand, but we're very reluctant to reach out for help when we need it ourselves. It's as if we've divided the world into those who offer help and those who need it. The truth is, we are both." See, I think a lot about the generosity of others because I was for a long time dependent on the generosity of others. I remember when I found myself on the opposite side of the us and them conversation in relation to poverty. Had I not had the support of the most important people in my life, I would not at this time be standing here. Deepak Chopra once said, "The universe operates through a dynamic of exchange. Giving and receiving are different aspects of the flow of energy in the universe. And in our willingness to give that which we keep the abundance of the universe circulating in our lives." When we talk about generosity, we focus on the giving side of generosity, which is reasonable in this context, especially here. We praise the giver, which is good because the giver ought to be praised. But often forget to thank the one who receives, because without them, the giver would have no need. A friend of mine was ordained by a tiny little church in Mississippi, 14 to 20 people in the congregation. This church raised thousands of dollars for her ordination. She went on to tell me that she felt bad because they have so little and this was so expensive. And in that moment, I had to remind her, because this is the thing that I'd had to remind myself in the years prior. Ordination is a privilege for a congregation, more so for a congregation of lesser means, especially one that has never ordained a minister. It's the reason our faith is a living tradition. It's the congregation becoming part of the greater whole of Unitarian Universalism, adding to our future. And what I said to her in response was, "Don't look at it that way. You gave this congregation an opportunity to do something they'd never done and to see what they are capable of." See, that reminder that they might have been small, but they weren't helpless, is one of the most important reminders we get in our lives sometimes, isn't it? She received a gift from them which was given in love with no expectation of reciprocity, and this was important for both sides, and had there been no one to receive the gift, there would be no reason to give it. For many, receiving the gift involves shame, because asking for help requires this immense vulnerability and trust. I am out of water. And when everything is falling apart, that can be hard to come by. It forces us to let go of control when all we want to do is grab hold of more control and put more things in order. It can feel like we put our worthiness in the hands of those who can't identify with us. And this fear is not unwarranted. On a very public level, gifts are synonymous with quid pro quo and can come with strings attached. We give not out of our goodness, out of the goodness of our heart, but with the expectation of reciprocity, a down payment on power. And for some, this is very true in politics. Giving turns into purchase agreement, and for others, it ties strings of power. Giving can create a power dynamic, especially when we divorce our giving from compassion. If we expect a return on our practice of generosity, we have to give compassionately. If we expect a return on our generosity, we are not rooting our giving in compassion. Because to truly practice generosity, we have to give compassionately, seeking the person who is receiving as an equal. And this can be difficult because our system is rooted in a meritocracy and whispers into our ear that we are where we are and they are where they are because of the choices that we make in isolation of where we started. When in fact, like wealth, poverty is also generational. See, my bootstraps had nothing to do with surviving my bout of homelessness. Sure, there was some resilience and fight, but I survived because I was willing to accept help and support from others. Had it not been for my vulnerability and the compassion of others, I would not be here. And let me tell you, it was hard for me to feel worthy of love when I couldn't afford to keep myself fed on a daily basis. When I depended on others for a place to sleep out of the heat and the cold, when a single mother split her income with me so I didn't starve. And the greatest of those people never asked for a quid pro quo. There was no expectation of reciprocity. They especially never required me to wallow in my shame, even though it comes naturally, doesn't it? Because what are we told? A man takes the bull by the horns. A man pounds the pavement. A man does not accept help. A man is self-sufficient. And if you accept help, you are not a man and you have no worth in this society. But see, the generosity I was shown was more than financial. This generosity was rooted in respect, in equity between individuals, in partnership between those that give and those that receive, and most of all, a reminder that we, those that have had to receive, are worthy of love. See, what makes asking for help so difficult sometimes is the vulnerability it takes to let go of the pride while still knowing that we are worthy of love. And what if that difficulty, or what if the difficulty in giving can be similar? What if giving with an open heart and no strings requires just as much vulnerability? At least it requires enough self-awareness, as we do not wish to weaponize our giving. When we give, not because we feel sorry for someone else or out of duty, but because we learn to see ourselves in this person, we give truly and compassionately with equity rooted in our own vulnerability. See, true generosity is not intended to separate us from them, but to bring us together. True generosity is not intended to separate us from them, but to unify. Generosity meets the needs of others, but it is not salvation. They do not need our salvation. I did not need their salvation. It It's simply another opportunity to build connections, to express our love centralized in our faith, further expanding our relationship with our human family. Because when we see ourselves in others, we give with the reminder that we too could be where they are. Generosity becomes a gift we receive in the giving. When we give openly and honestly and stay in touch with our own vulnerability, we offer something more than just the thing we offer. We offer acceptance, love, and remind those that might feel broken of their own worthiness. When we treat each other with dignity, we both win. Generosity, then, is not a string. It's a covenant. And the one who receives the gift is equal to the giver. Oh, we can give with strings and with power dynamics or expected quid pro quo, but that is not generosity. And it's surely not covenant. If we cannot thank the receptor for their vulnerability as equally important to the self or to the selflessness of the giver, we are not practicing generosity. Because true generosity is part of a covenant. And in our faith, covenant is always between equals. So, I started this story and stayed in a certain aspect of vulnerability because we never know what the receiver is going through. But we have to know that both the giver and the receiver are on equal footing. We don't give because we're saving. We give because it brings us in community together.